Welcome to the audio podcast of The Table at Central United Methodist Church. The podcast currently features the messages of Matt Smith and Linda Du Hirsu.
With a musical introduction by Brendan Lowe, our director of music. Thanks for listening. Centurion stands under the cross as Jesus is crucified in the accounts from Mark and Matthew and also from Luke. And in Matthew and Mark, both of those accounts have the centurion standing under the cross as Jesus breathes his final breath. And the centurion responds, "Truly, this man was God's son." The centurion stands under the cross, though, in Luke's gospel that we shared this evening and says, "Certainly this man was innocent." I have stood under this cross for 9 years now in this very community, and I've never noticed that difference before. As darkness covers the land in Matthew and Mark and John, Jesus cries out on the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me?" The Roman centurion's declaration in those gospels, "Truly this man is God's son," that invites us on Holy Friday into profound questions in those gospels about God and about Jesus and about the world. Like, for me, what does it mean to follow a fully divine Jesus who dies vulnerably with passion for love at the hands of empire while also feeling himself abandoned by God? Like, what do I do with that, that Jesus feels abandonment by God? What does this tell us about God's power, or about Jesus's power, or about our own? In short, in those accounts, the crucifixion of Jesus takes us into questions that in the church world we call Christology. Like, how do we make sense of Jesus in these moments? In contrast, a pastor, William Carter, writes, "Luke's primary concern is not Christology, but justice." See, in Luke's account, it's "certainly this man was innocent," not "this was God's son." I'm not sure how I've missed that all these years. I think in large part it's because I've been utterly taken by this experience of Jesus feeling God's absence at the end of his life while on the cross. See, if Jesus himself experiences a feeling of God absent amidst the most profound of suffering, then my own feelings of God's abandonment or my own wonderings about where God is or how God is showing up, they might be more legitimately faithful, is what I've wondered. Or if Jesus cries out on the cross, then my own crying out amidst the evil in our world might be legitimately faithful too. Yet this year, I've been taken in this different direction into the darkness of Holy Friday, into the heartbreak of God. See, the innocence of Jesus is woven throughout Luke's account. haven't always had eyes to see, and maybe this isn't news to many of you, but three times Pontius Pilate says that he has no basis to sentence Jesus to death. Even one of the criminals that's executed alongside Jesus declares that Jesus is innocent and undeserving of death. A few weeks ago, Pastor and Linda and I joined a few hundred other people at Grace Cathedral in San Francisco. It was a conference that's called Why Christian. It's hosted by Rachel Held Evans and Nadia Bowles Weber. And the format was simple enough. It was people who have been long marginalized by our Christian tradition, dominant expressions of our Christian tradition, women, people of color, genderqueer, LGBTQ people, were given space to share why be Christian. Like, why practice your faith? Why try to follow Jesus, given all the hurt and even horror that's been inflicted over the generations and into today? Innocence and suffering were woven throughout the reflections that were shared during those 2 days at Grace Cathedral. And if you haven't been, Grace Cathedral is, well, it's a cathedral. It's huge. It's enormous. And the seating of the space, so we're kind of in this round space. In Grace Cathedral, the speakers were elevated up on a stage, is what I'll call it, in kind of the middle point. And so the seating would have gone this way, or over on the left, or over on the right, or behind. So you get the sense it's a cross. And Linda and I are late to everything, so we sat over on this side and looked up at the speakers that were in that space. And the first woman who came to the stage, who's standing up above us, she shared, she's an undocumented Mexican-American Episcopal priest in Southern California, and she shared some of her family's migration story. And she named the uncertainty of her own status as a DACA recipient. It was a powerful testimony and witness. And then, honestly, the next few speakers are a blur. I have absolutely no idea what they shared. And then, in the evening, a young woman stood in the front, a young white woman. And she shared her own story about pregnancy loss. And you just felt the room shift. Or maybe I felt my body shift. Maybe there's no difference in my mind sometimes. You just were taken into this overwhelming grief that this young woman had experienced in losing a baby inside of her. And I didn't expect it. Her story brought up grief in me that I didn't realize was so unresolved. Maybe you've had that experience of someone says something and it takes you to that place. I didn't know I needed to spend a lot more time there. Augustine writes, "The tears streamed down, and I let them flow as freely as they would, making of them a pillow for my heart. On them it rested." I am no Augustine, so as quickly as the tears started to form for me, I started to have all of the coping mechanisms that came up to not go there, right? To not feel the feelings, the fire and the fury, the heartache. It's too much. So I went to that space. Brendan, I'll appreciate this. I might miss everyone else. Stuart Scott calls that place as cool as the other side of the pillow. So I quickly turned that pillow over. I could not stay in the grief of that space. The resistance to the powerful feelings within me actually began as I kind of had this outer body experience and started to try to learn more about what this woman was sharing. So I find myself going on my phone. It's a good coping mechanism when you don't want to stand under something that's hard to stand under. You can pull out your phone and you can look at it. That's a technique I use. And I looked up a quote that she referenced, and I found myself on her website, and I soon realized that she has had multiple miscarriages. This woman, like my partner Sarah and like me, she also has a young child. And then I found myself resisting her story. Like, I too had stood under that grief of pregnancy loss with The very fact, though, that I get to wake up in the morning and hear our daughter in jammies, like pitter-patter feet coming down, means that I view those losses of pregnancy loss completely differently than if I didn't hear that every morning. And so I found myself, full-on confession, I wanted to mansplain the like hierarchy of grief. I'm being like, that was where I was. And looking back, I can say now that my sense of like trying to rationalize the resistance to this was really just more me coping mechanisms, trying to resist or to keep at bay the fire and the fury that happens when you're standing under the true story of grief that you just can't really hold looking at, whether it's a cathedral or it's right here in the beauty of this space or wherever it is in your life. Because resistance like that is just real. And I do it a lot, I do it all the time. Resistance like this is also something that happens over and over and over and over throughout the Gospels. See, Jesus reminded the people in his own hometown of Nazareth that God's love is for outsiders. And as soon as he does that, they try to throw him over a cliff. That's pretty big resistance. They didn't have phones at that time to like hold back. Jesus reminded the folks as he's teaching on the Sabbath, right? He's curing people in Capernaum. And they say, Jesus, leave us alone. From the very beginning of his ministry, Jesus is faced with resistance because he came in the power of God's love and Spirit. And perhaps the one thing that is as constant as Jesus' radically inclusive vision of God's beloved community is the way it was met with resistance, or what the church traditionally talks about as sin. Jesus healed the sick, cast out demons, broke bread with those on the margins, puts on vulnerability, and rides humility into confrontation with empire in Jerusalem, and the resistance intensifies, and it culminates in a deadly lynching. Were you there when they nailed him to a tree? Pontius Pilate resists Jesus, but he refuses to take responsibility for executing him. And then we see the internal struggles of resistance within Jesus' own faith community rise, and a mob mentality takes over and it consumes the crowd. In Matthew's account, it says that the chief priests and the elders persuaded the crowds. And in Luke's account, it says it's the chief priests and the leaders of the people. However we spin it, anti-Jewish worldviews have tragically shaped the ways that Christian people have read these accounts over the generations. See, Christians have stripped Jesus, as we've heard these words tonight, of his own Jewish identity and blamed Jewish people for Jesus' death. In the name of Jesus, these Christian communities have sought to resist and even eliminate the very Jewish faith that Jesus practiced his entire life. It's yet another way that we resist meeting Jesus for who he is. And often, friends, it is to deadly ends. The truth and the depth of God's story made known in Jesus is something that's been resisted since the moment it came on the scene. And on the other side of this struggle, lest I kind of take myself out of that because I don't read the text in that way, in progressive Christian communities, we have placed blame almost entirely on Roman Empire. And in the name of Jesus, these communities, and I tend to count myself in this group, have sought to resist and eliminate empire. It's the other side of that space. And maybe part of the undeniable power of these accounts is the way that they confront us with the seemingly endless ways that we're always already resisting and seeking to eliminate Jesus. We tend to think, or at least I tend to think, that if I do everything right, if I practice my faith, if I have enough authenticity in the way I do that, if I reach in love with enough passion, then I can create the outcomes that I desire, the outcomes that I honestly believe God desires. My life can make a difference. God's day of peace will come when I do my part. The centurion spoke aloud that Jesus was innocent as Jesus breathed his final breath. The centurion does not stop the execution. Instead, the Roman centurion simply stands under the cross and says what's utterly true. An innocent man was killed. William Carter says it this way. This is what Luke wants us to see when we look at the cross. Jesus comes to a village and city in perfect goodness, and people can't handle it. In the memorable words of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, God lets God's self be pushed out of the world onto the cross. The passion narratives, as these stories are called, invite us to stand under the brokenness as we seek to understand the human condition. The human condition, the way we seem hell-bent on pushing Jesus out of the world and onto the cross. Like that young Episcopal priest who spoke at Grace Cathedral, her family's story of migration, this is a young woman that knows well what it's like to be persecuted by a state. She lived a version of the story that we call sacred and continues to make choices to speak out against dehumanizing immigration policies that push marginalized brown people onto the cross today. She does so at risk in her own life. And halfway around the world that God so loves, just this week, Norwegian youth gathered in acts of civil resistance by provocatively displaying themselves on crosses and city centers. These young people want the world, the people of the world, to stand under the cross. To stand under the cross that we're inflicting upon the world that God so loves. To challenge the people of the world to face the fact that our actions and inactions, our policies, our consumption, crucify our youth and the generations to come. Some of our complicity is conscious, some is not. Either way, we push Jesus out of the world by resisting the truth. God so loves the world, God gave God's only Son. I came to hear that phrase from John's gospel differently as the next speaker came to the stage at Grace Cathedral. She was an associate pastor of a large United Methodist church, a growing church in Houston, Texas. Her story was also one of innocence and suffering. She became pregnant. This was the first time she had shared this story publicly. She became pregnant out of wedlock. And the pastor, the lead pastor at her church, and her partner, and her community of faith supported her as she moved through pregnancy to have what would be her first child. And then several months before her due date, she went into active labor. And her baby was born and then died just a little while later. And unlike the previous speaker, she doesn't have another child to hear those feet in the morning. She left ministry and she's finding her way. It's several years later now. She's an artist and her paintings capture, this is done by Eric today, and a lot of Eric's art goes into the darkness. Her paintings capture some of what she's experienced and what she continues to experience and find her way in the process of grief. Her story gave me new understanding into what it might mean to believe with John that Jesus was God's only Son. Ugh. That utterly singular love that this woman had for her innocent little baby that died just after taking a few breaths. That child was filled with the Spirit, and that kind of loss can't be rationalized or explained. There's an ethicist, a philosopher. His name is Nicholas Wolterstorff, and he writes in a book about the death of his own son, Lament for a Son, these words. He writes, please, don't say it's not really so bad, because it is. Death is awful, demonic. If you think your task as comforter is to tell me that really, all things considered, it's not so bad, you do not sit with me in my grief. But place yourself off in the distance away from me, over there, and you are of no help. What I need to hear from you is that you recognize how painful it is. I need to hear from you that you are with me in my desperation. To comfort me, you have to come close. Come sit beside me on my mourning bench. I know people do sometimes think things are more awful than they really are, and such people need to be corrected gently, eventually. But no one thinks death is more awful than it is. It's those who think that it's not so bad that need correcting, he closes. And so today we gather with Christians around the world and stand under the cross. And we're confronted with the same reality that the Roman centurion acknowledged. This man was innocent. Ta-Nehisi Coates titled an article that he wrote in The Atlantic just 2 years ago after a quote from Frederick Douglass. He writes, to understand, a man must stand under. Frederick Douglass was reflecting on the understanding that only comes from standing under enslavement, from devoting his whole life to freeing God's beloved children. Dr. James Cone writes, Jesus was the first lynchee who foreshadowed all the lynched black bodies on American soil. He was crucified by the same principalities and powers that lynched black people in America. So to understand, a person must stand under. And this is the invitation of Holy Friday. It seems to me that this is our only real work. To stand under the cross in all its ancient and all its contemporary expressions. To find ourselves alongside that Roman centurion, understanding by simply standing under the brutal reality of an innocent person executed at the hands of evil. Again, William Carter writes, Jesus has done nothing wrong. His way is the true way. If we follow him, we must honestly appraise the situations before us. We have the choice to push ourselves away from every form of cruelty. An authentic faith takes root when we decide, for the sake of Jesus, that I'm no longer going to participate in something that is vindictive, punitive, or evil. And that stand takes great courage. It will certainly provoke its own controversy and opposition, but the way of Jesus is the holy way, the nonviolent way, the discipleship way. It is the narrow way to the reign of God. Many months ago, as we were planning this worship series that we're calling Restoration, we decided that we were going to call Holy Friday Setback. And setback on the surface seems utterly inadequate for tonight. But as I've tried to keep myself standing under the weight of all the ways we're all complicit in resisting and eliminating Jesus from our day-to-day lives, setback seems appropriate. It's like I can't stay under there, so I set back, and all of this keeps happening. It's an utterly commonplace word. On the surface, it seems benign. Yet setback, from the restoring love of Jesus might just be the most apt way to describe the truth of my faith journey. And Holy Friday is nothing if not a reminder of how pervasively true this is, not just for me as an individual, but for communities and for the world. So instead of placing ourselves at a distance this Holy Friday, it seems our task is to join with those suffering in our world by standing under the very reality of the cross as we hold fast to a God who loved and still loves and will always so love the world. Amen.